Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. This is Laurie Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information. You can also find links there to help you like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us through that page or on Gmail at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. On this week's Old Mole Variety Hour, we continue to examine how the far-right Trump administration's attacks on immigrants are affecting our communities. In the first part of today's show, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talk about immigration politics through the lens of the June 26th Supreme Court decision that partially upheld Trump's travel ban, and they discuss the psychological dynamics of various forms of anti-immigrant propaganda. Bill Resnick concludes his two-part interview with Larry Kleinman, co-founder of PEKUN, Oregon's farm worker organization, who discusses organizing in a period of crisis where white supremacy and voter suppression are contributing to anti-immigrant hysteria despite the economic and cultural centrality of immigrants in Oregon and the U.S. Finally, Jan Hocken and Denise Morris review the film Wonder Woman and the history of the comic book character and her status as a feminist icon. Is it a masterpiece of subversive feminism or yet another affirmation of the stereotypical objectified woman in a lead surrounded by men? Stay tuned for another hour of enlightened programming on KBOO. Now here are Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker to discuss the fallout from Trump's travel ban.
Well, Mike, in between the Twitter attacks and the media last week, Trump displayed his triumphant side in declaring the Supreme Court decision last Monday a vindication of his travel ban. So let's talk about the Supreme Court decision and the curious aspect of it being a unanimous Supreme Court decision, what it says about the travel ban, and then we'll talk about some of the broader border politics in play.
Well, Jen, it was unanimous only in one sense, that they all agreed that they would partially uphold the travel ban. Three members dissented strongly. They thought the whole thing should be affirmed strongly.
The conservatives.
Yeah, absolutely. But the six members of the Supreme Court looked at the hardships the ban would create for the named plaintiffs in these cases, which were two men with family members who wanted to come to the U.S. from the affected countries, and the state of Hawaii, whose state university had admitted students from those countries. the court explained that this lower court order's barring enforcement of the ban reached much further than that because it applied to people living overseas who they said had no connection to the U.S. at all. But if you did have a legitimate connection, a bona fide family relationship, or an invitation from a college or an employer who wanted to hire you, then their constitutional rights were violated.
So, you know, it'd be interesting to do a little survey of people getting off airplanes from that country and a little checklist of bona fide criteria. I would suspect most of them meet some standard of bona fide. It's one of those ideological terms that implies some vetting that's not already in place. And of course, you cannot get through customs. You're asked, why are you here? There's already a kind of extreme bar. So this does seem like much ado about nothing, but of course it is a part of a larger game.
So what is a bona fide reason to come? By the way, you're right about that, in that 90% of the people who are affected will be able to continue to come. It's not if only those people with no conceivable relationship or arguable reason who are banned from coming. And already it's a very steep hill to get a visa or to be allowed to come.
And to have the resources to get on a plane. And it's a different issue, people flying in from far away and the resources required to do that, than the border politics along
Absolutely.
The southern border, which we'll hopefully get to later. So what about the organizing potential, too, around this issue? Because there will be litigation, of course, as there are on many fronts. But, I mean, one issue is the enormous power the executive branch has around immigration politics. That's one issue.
Well, they always have. It's immigration exceptionalism. It's a part of the law that the courts have really deferred to the executive branch. That's colliding against the guarantees against racial and religious discrimination, which in a way prevailed in this decision. The conservatives said the decision is unworkable because there's going to be tons of litigation over just what is a bona fide reason. And of course, he's right. There'll be the summer of litigation, because why can your grandfather not come? What if your grandfather raised you or had a significant part in your upbringing?
It's nuclear familialism that's given priority here rather than extended kin.
That's right. But the extended kin will be able to make a case, and they will be making cases all summer long until the case is finally argued next October.
But I think with the refugee politics, there's another ethic and ethos that is at stake. We need to emphasize that the social bonds are formed not just on the basis of next of kin or extended kin, but our larger obligations to one another. And that this is an area, too, where there's a hard limit that Trump has imposed arbitrarily, have the number of refugees who can come in the country. There are battles now over how many of those refugees that are permitted will meet the criteria bona fide through their relationships with resettlement refugee organizations. That's one issue. But it seems like a larger issue is, what are our obligations to one another beyond kin?
Those are defined in economic good times. People are generally indifferent to immigration. And that's when immigrants come in large numbers, in droves, because there are jobs, there are opportunities in the U.S.
Even policies that promote, like the Braceros program, that was during the 50s and 60s, right?
Where a blind eye is turned to what's, mm-hmm. what's happening. But when things are bad, that's when the fear of the other, the general fear itself becomes large part of people's lives. Scapegoating of other people is blaming them for the downturn in their lives individually. In the 30s, there were Mexican shipped back to Mexico in boxcars, like Jews being sent to concentration camps from Arizona and all over the Southwest without anyone noticing. It was a revulsion against anyone different, anybody who was seen to be undercutting people's existences. But now we have a bifurcated economy. The West Coast is thriving. It's doing very well economically.
And that's California. That's part of the political picture in California that has a very large Latino population and a strong, I mean, you could overstate it, but sanctuary city movement. And some cities are predominantly Latino, as are their city councils. But Texas is more is kind of a mixed picture politically.
It is. It's the perfect
close
mixed
to
picture.
Half of Texas is Latino.
Yeah, and like Austin is part of the economic boom. It's got a big Apple branch there. It's entertainment center. It's got lots of high-tech stuff. All the parts of the economy that are doing well are present in Austin. Austin's a sanctuary city. But Texas has just passed the most repressive law about immigrants you can imagine, SB 4. And it bans, among other things, sanctuary cities. So there are blue cities throughout Texas, which are isolated in a sea of small declining villages and smaller cities that are doing badly. So the politics of Texas are the place where both these issues are colliding the loudest. Up and down this coast, the refugee movement in favor of refugees is articulate and pretty strong. Around the country, huge areas of the country are strongly supportive of everything Trump can do to keep out foreigners.
And indeed, the House last week passed with a vote of 228 to 195, the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act, playing on sanctuary. And let's talk about what's meant by criminality here in this act. And it clearly draws on the fear you're describing.
What it does is it turns anyone who's been deported and then who gets caught coming back into this country as a serious criminal. It's not just a matter of trying to evade borders. It becomes a serious crime. It's an effort to get this catch and release, quote unquote, theory gone, which is what has been in effect. The people are simply turned around and shipped back, but now they will be incarcerated. You wonder why private prison stock boomed when Trump was elected. This whole drift toward incarcerating people who have fled oppressive environments in Central America. There are teenagers who are confined indefinitely now in a series of prisons built along the borders owned by private companies that have a very difficult time being represented, finding someone to talk to about their status. And this process of criminalizing and therefore justifying extended periods of confinement for people
for crossing the border.
For crossing the border a second time is part of this whole wave toward criminalizing and limiting and incarcerating. It's an extraordinary expansion of lockups.
And these are borders that for long periods of our history were, and not even so far back, were places where people could go back and forth with ease.
That's true.
And then that those same passages become criminalized. So there's clearly a powerful resonance of this idea of borders. And a number of social scientists have talked about how society's undergoing change, destabilizing changes, become preoccupied with the borders of the body, particularly women's borders. I think abortion politics become part of that, the sanctity of the fetus, and also the nation's borders, kind of fortifying and defending borders. So what about the borders along the southern border, which evokes passages of people walking on foot, versus the borders of our airports? And you have a different kind of discourse around Muslims, which is more of a religiously inflected, oriented prejudice, versus Mexicans coming across the border. They're similar in a way, kind of paranoia about the other, but they're also different.
It has different forms. And the Muslims in this country are generally pretty well off. They're generally pretty conservative. It's not easy to get a plane ticket and get over here. They're very well educated for the most part. the Muslims.
And come from very different countries.
Come from very different countries.
Yeah.
Muslims in the ghettos of Paris and London have had to walk. They've struggled. They haven't been able to fly planes. They've been chased out of their native countries by bombs that we drop and that England has dropped. And there's a whole different social
The ones class. That end up on the shores of Italy versus flying into the U.S. to JFK.
Yeah, there's a tremendous, dislocation throughout the Middle East, and Europe catches the brunt of it. We are barely touched by the repercussions of what we've done over there.
And yet you go to these Trump rallies, and there are these declarations against Sharia law. And it's like, that we're not going to allow that to be declared in this country. And it's like psychotic.
It
Whereas,
is.
The influx of Latino communities is real, but the threat is crazy. So it's different kinds of paranoia operating here.
Yeah, the truth is that people don't come up south of the border much now for economic reasons. They do to some extent, but nothing like, say, 10 years ago. But there are significant numbers of people fleeing horrible governments, like, for example, in Honduras, where a coup we engendered has led to Honduras becoming the murder capital of the world, patrolled in many parts by gangs formed originally in Los Angeles and here. But it's just a society that is the nearest thing to a failed state in the Western Hemisphere.
So there is some of that shutting out the horrors of the south of the border that have been generated by our government.
And lots of those kids, by kids I mean 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds who've walked and hitchhiked and made it up to the border and are now being incarcerated in private prisons.
Yeah. So, Mike, we'll continue to follow the border politics, and clearly the Supreme Court decision is just one moment in an ongoing series of tragedies, but also potential for resistance and organizing. So we'll carry on with this.
Good.
It's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about the Supreme Court decision last week and border politics.
Documentos, mírame a los ojos para que leas mi acento. Prohibido como la droga, ilegal como un nazi en una sinagoga. Contraindicado, clandestino, lo identificable, lo contamino. Más de 600 millones de personas gritando luz verde para invadir Arizona. No necesito diplomas, lo que aprendí lo viví y lo almaceno en mis neuronas. Las experiencias son mis talleres. La vida es un estudio desde que se nace hasta que se muere. Así crucé pa'l norte buscando buena vida, componente vacío de materia consumida. Dejé a mi abuela sola pa' besarle el culo a Ronald McDonald y tomar Coca-Cola.
Todos somos ilegales. Todos somos ilegales. Todos somos ilegales.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. That was Todos Somos Ilegales with Residente and Tom Morello. And we heard from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker. Now Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman, co-founder of the PayCoon, Oregon's farmworker organization, continue the discussion about the politics of immigration. This is the second part of the interview. Last week, Bill and Larry introduced what has happened under Trump and the forces in struggle. Today, they discuss how the far right are embracing white supremacy as a strategy and how immigrants and their allies are fighting back.
Larry Kleinman, welcome to the second part of our two-part interview on immigration.
Thanks, Bill. Great to be here again.
Larry knows immigration and farm work. He was co-founder of PayCoon, Oregon's farm work organization, for 35 years and counting. He spent a lot of time all over the state on the ranches and farms organizing, and in Woodburn helping to run the organization. In his spare time, he lobbied the Oregon legislature. He did countless trainings, developed farm worker housing around Woodburn, raised money, developed legal support organizations, and established radio. What are your call letters?
K KPCNLP, Radio Movimiento, 95.9 FM.
Repeat KP.
KPCN, like Pekun.
Oh,
LP, low right. power, established in 2006.
They're a Spanish language station with a very large audience because of its reports and alerts about anti-immigration action and enforcement. Then over the last 5 years, Pekun is transitioning to new day-to-day leadership, and Larry, while still advising and working in Woodburn, has been working on the national scene. So Larry, give us a sense of all your work today.
So the national scene that I'm on more now, I'm in D.C. about half-time, and also moving around the country. I work with the network of immigrant rights organizations like Pekun and Causa in 35 states, and my role is to advise them on how to build their programs, their strategies to defend immigrants, especially now that we're dealing with the threat of mass removals, mass deportations, mass arrests.
Part of that is working at the state level, trying to stop the cruelest kinds of enforcement, also working at the state level and the national level on legislation and policy and the sort of the direction of the various agencies.
My role in that is a step or two removed, but I'm engaged in various of those arenas. I think the most important role I play now nationally is to work with the immigrant rights leaders, many of whom are newer to this work, to politics, to legal defense, to the many things that Pekun and before it the Willamette Valley Immigration Project, our trajectory of development took us through many of those stages. Mm-hmm. Now folks, in many cases, sadly, we are revisiting, having to rebuild or build anew these kinds of capacities. That's where I have valuable right. experience.
And also, I guess, how to work in the fields and in the cities and in the industries. Organizing is a major part of every one of these organizations, is getting a Latino community alert and active and struggling.
There's brilliant work going on. There's innovative work. There's work I couldn't imagine. I'm not the right person to lead or advise. But on the other hand, what we know is this work is cyclical. We've been in periods of crisis before. There were particular characteristics to it then, and there are others now, but there are things about it that have to do with how do we shape our expectations? What are the strategies we're using in which I can actually offer some useful ideas?
Let's talk about the big national picture now as corporate America is being squeezed. Many, many industries are being squeezed by the lack of labor and the lack of labor that they need. And they want to get that labor. They have to have it or they lose huge amounts of money in production. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Republican Party, who has ginned up this immigration scare. Parts of it seem to be, we've discussed it before, are really adamant. Tell us the story of what's happening in policy circles in the states, I suspect, especially the agricultural states, and the national government.
It is amazing to behold what started in the Tea Party movement most recently as the Republican establishment embracing that for its pushback effects and potential on the agenda that they didn't want of the Obama administration and anything more progressive than that, now has become a force that they really can't control. One of the key accelerants of that, in my view, and it's a totally different discussion for another day, is gerrymandering, by which I mean the fact that there are so many congressional districts now that are so much of one party, in this case, Republicans, that the Republican primary has become the general election. And the Tea Party has become very effective in challenging establishment power in the Republican Party in these primaries. And so what you have is members of Congress starting, I would say, most noticeably 3 years ago, who are deathly afraid not of being unelected in the general election by a Democrat, but being unseated for the nomination by a Republican candidate in the primary. And so if you have an ginned up base, the so-called Trump voters, the most vociferous ones, and they're hearing the call of white supremacy, a white restoration, of get the brown people out of here, don't allow any more brown people in this country. They are an organized political force. They are incredibly potent in the Republican primary, and that's what is challenging the establishment. Yeah,
and one other thing I think that is promised by this policy is they're going to get good jobs again. Somehow we're going to return to the good old days when we could work for a decent wage, raise our family, and be respected on the streets by all of these lower people who are somehow in the neighborhoods.
And in many rural communities, actually return to a vibrant or more vibrant economy on Main Street. There are thousands of towns in rural Iowa, in central Pennsylvania, and many places around where first you had Main Street hollowed out. So you had many vacant establishments, vacant buildings. Then you had gradually a trickling in of immigrant communities who started small businesses. Many of those small businesses served the immigrant community, but they were paying rent to the landlords, who were the traditional folks in that community or the longstanding beacons of establishment. So the economy is doing a little better in some of these places, and folks are glad to be there. They're not really asking for anything specifically, the new arrivals, but the social transformation, those traditionalists can feel it coming, and combined with what you described as the lack of economic security and the lack of social standing is a poisonous brew. That is now poisoning Republican politics to ways in which the powers that be, the chambers of commerce, the grower associations, even now high tech, never imagined could happen.
They've lost control. That whole establishment now is lost control of the party and of policy, and particularly of immigration policy.
So this is then accelerated by the campaign of fear. So suddenly immigrants aren't coming to those places because they're afraid. And rightly so, right? They're rightly so
sure,
to be afraid.
They can be easily, much more easily picked off
exactly.
than in a big city.
And the social setting is more hostile, right, than in a big city neighborhood maybe, where there's a critical mass. And so the industry owners, the slaughterhouses in Western Iowa.
These big companies, big companies.
Who have depended on this labor, then are being squeezed by the enforcement regime. Wow. That's a recipe for bankruptcy.
And the farmers in Oregon, they're having trouble getting labor, I guess. Mm-hmm. Are the wages going up in the fields? I guess they probably are.
Yeah, I'm not as in touch with that day-to-day anymore, but broadly, I think there's upward pressure on wages. Another thing, of course, happening is the number of apprehensions at the border are way down, way down. There were more people apprehended, Bill, in October, 1 month, October last year, than in the entire span of 4 months, February through May. 4 months equal to 1 month. Here, another statistic that floored me that I just heard the other day, the immigration apparatus, the Border Patrol and ICE, are the biggest law enforcement organization in the nation, or if in the federal government, bigger than all the others combined, a correct statistic. There are 17,000 agents assigned to the southern border. They arrested 14,000 people in the month of May. That's less than one arrest per agent for the entire month, right? What are these folks doing, right? I mean, are they the in the old commercial cliche of the Maytag repairman, the guy sitting there with nothing to do, right? And then they want 5,000 more? Like, to do what exactly?
Yeah,
right.
Well, they have to repair their own cars, which are always breaking. And I mean, they have this huge apparatus. Like the army, the number of fighters is relatively small in comparison to this whole logistical apparatus.
Yeah, that's
that
right,
they
to keep it all going. anyway, so I think that the number of people coming in the country is less. So the transitory labor, you could call it, some people call it migrant labor, but the casual labor, the transitory labor, the contingent labor is under, that market is under great pressure.
And what's happening in politics now where all of these companies are finding themselves under enormous pressure, actually it must be. They see themselves being unable to produce and their expenses are going up enormously. I mean, to some extent, because they have to offer people a lot more money.
Well, so there's two responses. If your business is a business that can be relocated to some other location, that's what you're probably doing. High tech is a great example, right? So the high tech visas are also affected by this trend. There's incredible pressure to reduce the number of high tech visas for the computerized industries. So what is Microsoft doing? They're expanding the shop that they've set up in Vancouver, British Columbia, because they have a better arrangement through the Canadian government. They're setting up more operations in Asia, so they don't have to bring people here at all.
Oh.
But if you're a farm, you're a dairy farmer in Idaho, right? You are not moving your dairy to Alberta. Or I don't know, maybe you could try to sell your dairy and go buy one in Alberta. I don't know. But that's a way easier said than done, right? And if you don't have workers on the job every day, milking those cows, your cows die in a matter of days and your entire operation collapses. And so the dairy operators in Idaho, for example, who for the longest time felt that they were the kings of the political hill in the Republican Party, which totally dominates politics in the state of, in most parts of the state of Idaho, suddenly find themselves completely vulnerable. And there's a level of freak out and anxiety that I think I have never seen, even in 40 years in the time that I've had working around.
And it's not just these dairy farmers where the cows die in a couple of days, but also berries rot in a couple of days, and agricultural products, they're fragile. And
perishable.
Perishable. Yeah.
So the kind of fear that we saw in the growers' eyes in 1995 when we attempted to foment a general strike in the strawberry harvest to get a crop-wide wage increase, which we basically achieved. We didn't achieve the strike, we achieved the increase. That kind of fear that I saw in their eyes is the fear I see today, Bill. And they're not afraid of us. They're not afraid of worker organizing. That's not what's putting the pressure on as it did so acutely in the 90s. What they're afraid of is their own party that has been taken over by the closed, shut the doors, no more immigration, get rid of the folks that are here, politics, depriving them of their labor supply.
This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking immigration policy today with Larry Kleinman, one of the co-founders of Pikun, the Oregon Farm Workers Union, work there in the fields and building Pikun for 35 years or so in Oregon. For the last couple of years, he's transitioned to spending half time in Woodburn and the other half traveling around the country, and especially being in Washington, D.C., advising immigration rights and organizations on how to deal with the political climate and to organize all of the issues that face poor communities. Larry, we were talking about the immense pressure now within the Republican Party that the corporate sector has lost the battle, at least up until now, to keep their immigrant workers that they desperately, undocumented and documented, that they desperately need to this immigration scare that's been ginned up. My sense was, before talking to you today, that they were going to be able to come up with some kind of slave labor program, like the Bracero program of the 50s, where immigrant labor was brought in on buses, deposited in hovels on farms, and were utterly dependent on the owner, who basically had a slave population, and then shipped back from time to time. Everybody terrorized and basically and working for very, very low wages. But it doesn't appear that the Republican Party can agree on that. Is that what you're pointing out?
Yeah, that's exactly what the reality is right now, the state of play. Now, it's hard to say what will happen in such unstable politics, but I have to say, Bill, that this force that thought it was so uppermost and essential, that by which I mean the growers and their political influence, are getting no traction on Capitol Hill. They're getting no bills that do exactly what you just described in a fashion, even if they try to cover with a fig leaf. There are sworn enemies of any kind of immigration, legal, undocumented, temporary, inhabiting the highest positions of influence in the White House and in the immigration apparatus.
They won't even let European labor from Poland and Romania come in,
well,
or
that,
Russia?
That discussion hasn't started yet that I know of. They're all in favor of white people immigrating, but they get it that the way the system is now does not advantage that. So their sort of knee-jerk reaction to that, or their immediate reaction to that, is let's shut down the system as it is now. Exactly how they would redesign it to expressly advantage white people is sort of another chapter that, I mean, it's early days in all this still. Uh-huh. But nonetheless, their agenda is shut it down. Shut down arrival of temporary workers, shut down arrival of permanent residents, cut it in half. Let's reduce the number of people applying for citizenship, and let's get rid of the people that are here now.
That can't last. It's completely unsustainable. That labor is all by the various industries. You described earlier Microsoft is now expanding their plant in British Columbia in order to be able to import people from China and India, probably.
Exactly.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
these technical workers mm-hmm. That they've come to depend on. I was thinking, you too, that they might also go to Mexico, or in fact just set up in China and India, which is what they've also been doing.
Well, I think there's different parts. I think their engineering function is more the British Columbia.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Production is all in China already and has been for decades. The reason, of course, it's for Vancouver, it's right there by Redmond, Washington. You know, it's just right across the border. I mean, it's quite convenient.
You can telecommute, but it's just not quite as good as having a meeting sometimes. Yeah.
And they have a critical mass of workers now there, and they've been building that for a while because they saw the handwriting, the instability handwriting on the wall. I think they did not imagine that it would get to these extremes.
So, in fact, this whole policy is now costing American jobs. This is another source of outsourcing and of leaving the country.
The reality that Republicans generally, and the anti-immigrant Republicans in particular, don't want to acknowledge is how much of a driver of economic growth immigration is. Immigration and immigrants are, whether it's small business in a particular dying community or large corporations. And corporations, of course, what they want to be able to do is move their money around and move their workers around with as few limitations as possible. And the anti-immigration wing ascendancy in the Republican Party is really putting a crimp in their style.
What's the future look like in terms of immigration policy? It is unsustainable. What are the possible scenarios, and how can progressives and the left influence it?
God, it's really hard to tell how this movie is going to turn out, because this is, I mean, you got to believe that there has to be a come to Moses, as I like to say. I'm not one of those come to Jesus folks. There has to be a come to Moses inside the Republican Party, but that has already been building for a while, and it's still getting worse. It's still getting more extreme, more polarized. So I think until we see what's going to happen to Trumpism and the Trump phenomenon, I think that immigration is part and parcel of that. Of course, he made that central to his run. So we got to see what happens to him, the opposition to him, the disenchantment with him, the resistance to him, the withdrawal of support. So some of corporate America that said, well, okay, we'll try to live with the guy because he's a Republican. And as FDR once said, he's our SOB, you know. But when they get to their breaking point, how is their pullback going to express itself in a way that displaces or dislodges him? So until we see that, I think we're hard-pressed to predict what will happen on immigration. Meanwhile, however, states like California are going to build the most supportive environment they possibly can. And I wouldn't even rule out the possibility of an attempt to take to the Supreme Court the proposition that states could issue their own visas, even though it seems to me it's patently unconstitutional.
I guess one other part of that, besides working in the states to fight the immigration policies and make room for immigrants and immigrant labor, there's still the necessity in every community, and I'm sure you see it, to organize on the ground for both self-defense, for mutual help in communities, as well as politically to, and in California, well, they've already done it, unseat them in at least the state legislature and probably in the congressional delegation, and places like Texas, which some people think is going to be purple and then blue fairly soon. But how do you really develop a progressive majority that will do anything? Because the Latin community right now is sort of united, but at some point, all of the class tensions are going to express themselves.
I totally agree with that. And I think in the short run, I think the big question is overreach. Will the overreach caused by the anti-immigrant wing, for one hand, the chaos of Trump, the repeal of the ACA, the roll-up of all of that, once it begins to bite, especially in places that were supportive of Trump and that support starts to erode, how do the politics shift? We all know that Trump did not win a sweeping landslide, and quite the opposite, actually. So the tipping point could be a lot closer than we imagine. And then in places like Texas, we saw in California was not always the progressive bulwark that it is today. In fact, it was Republican dominated for decades, and they overreached on the issue of immigration at a particularly inconvenient moment, it turned out for them. Question is whether the similar trajectory will be seen in Texas and how long it will take.
And a lot of that, of course, depends on the situation of the still plurality white working class. And if the whole economy begins tanking, they could well be organized, some at least could be organized into a vicious xenophobic sort of force. Everybody has to unite around a very different kind of economy. And then there's, of course, global climate change, which is going to affect every industry, particularly agriculture, in bad ways. I think we're looking at a really troubled sort of future in the next 20, 30, 50 years for
Global climate change is going to scramble agriculture. It's going to help agriculture in some places and totally decimate it in others. Yeah. And it's also going to scramble immigration as folks live in unsustainable environments, you know, even from going from minimally sustainable to completely unsustainable, uninhabitable, in fact. Today, the day we're recording this, planes couldn't take off from Phoenix because it was too hot. Wow. There's a sign for you.
Yeah. Larry Kleinman, thanks a lot for your work and for talking to us today.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate the opportunity and a big supporter of KBOO.
It's a hard line when you're an import, baby boy. It's hard times when you ain't sent for braces. Feed the belly of the beast with they pitchforks. Rich chores done by the people that get ignored. Ya se armó, ya se despertaron. It's a whole awakening. La alarma ya sonó hace rato. Los que quieren buscan, pero nos apodan como vagos. We're the same ones hustling on every level. Ten los datos. Walk a mile in our shoes. Abróchense los zapatos. I've been scoping y'all dudes. Y'all ain't been working like I do. Why y'all work ya? It hurt ya. You claim I'm stealing jobs. Oh, Peter Piper claimed he picked them. He just underpaid Pablo. But there ain't a paper trail when you living in the shadows. We America's ghost riders. The credit's only borrowed. It's a matter of time before the checks all come. But
immigrants, we get the job done. Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come. We get the job done. Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Immigrants, we get the job.
Yeah.
You heard Immigrants, We Get the Job Done with Snow the Product from Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton mixtape. And you also heard from Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Old Mole Variety Hour. You can donate to Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, PECUN's ICE raid resistance efforts by going to the website PECUN.org, PCUN.org. And now we hear from Jan Hocken and Denise Morris reviewing the new film Wonder Woman.
Thank you, Lori. Yes, this is Denise Morris and Jan Hocken this morning. We did see Wonder Woman, here. And it was loud and wild and interesting, and it's swirling with controversy.
We're not
in
sure
and outside.
How wonderful it was.
We're not sure. Yeah, wonderful. Nice. The film was directed by Patty Jenkins, and it stars Gal Gadot, infamously now Israeli actress, and Chris Pine with his baby blues. He does have pretty eyes. Yeah. The Wonder Woman of 2017 is the origin story of the iconic DC comic book superhero. And Wonder Woman, first appearing in 1941, was created by an American psychologist and writer, William Moulton Marston. And Marston drew inspiration from early feminists. The Amazonian warrior was sculpted from clay by her mother, Queen Hippolyta, and she was given life and superhuman powers as gifts by the Greek gods. Initially, Wonder Woman's golden age, she had her crime-fighting origins taking place during World War II as she wins the right to return Steve Trevor to his, quote, man's world homeland, and so that she can fight crime and evil of the Nazis. Trevor is a United States intelligence officer whose plane has crashed on the Amazon's isolated island. Jenkins' Wonder Woman, however, sees her return, Steve Trevor, to the Western Front towards the end of World War I, and that is kind of a critical distinction and lends at least the potential for some interesting war talk. We have villains, we have heroes, we've got evil genius, and it's all set in a very gritty depiction of the Great War in Europe and the battlefields and trenches. And I wanted to mention for reference, Patty Jenkins is also the director of Monster, and I believe that film came out in 2003.
That is the story of the narrative film telling the story of Eileen Warnes, who was the former prostitute convicted of a series of murders and executed in Florida in 2002.
Also
and that was
previously reviewed.
Also
by the
previously,
movie
if you want to dig back to 2002, we did review that and found it to be a very interesting film,
yes.
Actually.
Yes.
But Patty Jenkins' femaleness, her status as woman in the world, and the female-centered film, its feminism and subversion of the more male-centered superhero film counterparts has really dominated the public discourse. And so we're going to try to unpack that as well as look at some of the other concerns in the film that haven't been addressed as much. So Jan, starting with the creator, William Moulton Marston.
Also inventor of the lie detector test.
Ooh, good one.
Yeah.
He was a psychologist, and you're a psychologist, and this is the second time in a row we've reviewed a film that has psychology in it. Huh. Get Out was our last, so we're going to put you up to talk about psychology and the female superhero.
Well, he wasn't a Freudian, but there are some elements of this film that I think follow lines of psychoanalysis and depth psychology even during his lifespan. The idea that masculinity and hypermasculinity is a defense against a certain anxiety that women don't really need them, that women are stronger, so women have to be cast as dependent and vulnerable and needy because they're really not. and so this film kind of plays with, some of my favorite moments are when it plays with that theme. It gets overridden by a lot of the other action films and it's a problem with this idea of the natural superiority of women. If you take it too far, it kind of turns into its opposite, where the natural superiority of women is just that they really, really are like men or better men underneath their skirts. But
more pure violence.
A more pure, that's right.
Advanced, more skilled, yeah.
That's right. But there are a couple moments where this works very effectively, where our heroine is on a boat with what emerges as the male hero, and she's read a number of volumes of classical text on sexuality. So she knows about human sexuality. She says, well, actually, as it turns out, the conclusion is that men are required for reproduction, but not for pleasure.
Right.
And so there are many ways in which the film plays on that idea, the love among women, but the solidaristic ties among women are pretty much overridden in the course of the film by the romantic tie. As she enters the world of men, she's kind of on her own and really requires the support of these other ragtag group of guys. But on the other hand, the chief architect of the horrific chemical warfare mustard gas used by the Germans the First World War was a woman scientist. So you at least have one evil woman.
Right. I think one
that weaponry.
One reviewer said it was equal opportunity, you know, and that was a sign of subversive feminism, that you have to have, I mean, evil women have as much opportunity as any to be evil.
But they were tokens. So in a way, it's that the female characters were kind of a pure form of evil, a pure form of good amidst the humanity of men that was more of a mixed company in terms of morality. And I think this idea that he drew inspiration from early feminists, one of his two wives, life partners, was the niece of birth control pioneer Margaret Sanger, and he was apparently very much admired the suffragists and their militants during the first period of the First World War. And it, you know, it would have been interesting to set the film in that history of actual feminist struggle rather than a mythologized past that never did exist, the fantasy of a matriarchal, pre-patriarchal society. But of course, that's comic book conventions all drawn mythology.
You have to have a paradise, Jan. The film really does walk a line, and where actually I think there's less mythical than there is really kind of, I mean, it's very much set in this world that's depicted, I think, with a lot of grit and a lot of detail in terms of the savages of the war. Right.
Yeah.
And so while it is a Marvel film, and there's lots of Marvel-esque, you know, comic book elements to it, there's a sense of realism to it that kind of offsets all of the rest of that. But, you know,
and skillfully done. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the First World War had unfolded with massive protests. So you have this film where she discovers, and her world falls apart, that Ares, the god of war, is not the entire. It's not the whole of war isn't determined by the god of war. She kills him. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But then the machinery of war goes on. So then the second line of argument is that people are inherently evil. Mm-hmm. So if it's not just a god or a devil determining war, then what causes it? And so that's
right.
Second spoiler alert, people
right.
are bad.
Yeah, people are bad. And there's a lot that revolves around questions of truth and love and honor and duty and all of this kind of stuff, which leads people to talk about the film as whether or not it's actually an anti-war film or not. But most of that gets really kind of drowned out by the... Well, if the World War I was irrational, it seems to me that a lot of the response, in some sense, to the film is sort of irrational, because people are we so starved for films with women in them that we are going to manage to overlook some very serious concerns about how we reproduce over and over again this sensibility and ideological perspective about war and human nature.
Yes.
And without being able to make a true case as an anti-war film, you can show us the ravages of the war, but as long as there's a true enemy, then the reflection back on our own social, economic, political circumstances can't lead us to really dig deep and say, you know, look, war is this messy, messy thing, and in order to really confront it, We do need more than a superhero. And Wonder yeah. Woman says, well, it's not just one hero, but there's nothing else there. There's no look at...
other than love. And
right.
it played with this rationale that's ancient and still has tremendous currency, that the aim is peace, but war is the means of getting there. No one loves war, but we have to have war to end all war. And of course, the Great War was supposed to be the First World War, the war to end all wars. And then you see all of this celebratory post-war festivity and flag waving in London. And actually, there was enormous protest after the First World War about, in Britain, by soldiers of all of the government and the political class that sent them to war and suffered massive deaths. So there's no sense of protest within war. It's all a kind of the machinery of war marches on because people are evil, and that a woman who's a more rational fighter may be the way to prevail. I mean, it was in some ways a very reactionary movie and pro-war movie.
Yeah, I agree. And even some of the stuff that is entertaining and catchy, you know, her complete dedication to this idea that there's a force that can be destroyed leads her to do what she does in a number of scenes in which she just perseveres. No one can tell her what to do or not to do, which
right.
is sort of a funny, I mean, it's sort of interesting because isn't that always that's the dream of probably every woman, to just have the guys shut up and leave me alone
this,
or whatever.
This like, girl kicks major butt.
I'm going to do this, yeah. Only to
right.
find out that
he's always trying to discipline her and she refuses
right,
to
and that
yeah.
he has some understanding, or he says at one point, I can save the day, but you can save the world. And so there's the, you know, final.
The future's feminine.
Yeah.
Is that,
yeah.
that idea. And but there are also debates about this ideal woman prototype. And in some ways, she's not as bad as many. I mean, the camera focuses on her activity, her face, the movement, and doesn't linger pornographically mm-hmm. on her body. But there have also been debates about this white woman as a kind of ideal too.
And well, right, the and the whiteness in the movie and the use and the tokenism of black characters, particularly the one reviewer talked about the mammy character who is the caretaker of the young Wonder Woman when she's 8 years old and can't control her, and you know, it's just it's not, you know, it's all there and it's all true. It's not, it's again, you know, a film where white womanhood is dominant rules, and then there is no getting away from the reality that that the actress' position as a supporter of the attack on Palestinians in Gaza in 2014 is publicly documented.
Gal Gadot, who plays
and
Wonder
that
Woman.
there's how do you avoid the hypocrisy of the character crying out for on the behalf of children, but only certain children?
Again, yeah, when this is a film that is itself about war,
right? And all children, all people, whatever it is. I mean, she of course is taking the position of Israel as being the constant and perpetual victim of, you know, the Palestinians, and that has caused an enormous amount of strife. And we need to wrap up here, Jan. We are reviewing Wonder Woman.
Get a
bootleg. Don't go pay for it. This is Denise Morris and Jan Hocken for The Old Mole.
That's it for The Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Laurie Mercier, and thanks to Patsy Kohlberg for engineering today, and to our contributors, Jan Hocken and Denise Morris. You just heard their review of Wonder Woman. And to Mike Snedeker, Bill Resnick, and Larry Kleinman. You can listen to the show again via podcast on kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks again for listening.